Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Cullerton.
With Nifty Business, the fleet management specialists. Keeping your business fleet moving with service you can count on.
This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. Coming up on today's show, fail again, fail better and fail faster. We look at the economics of failure and ask, have we completely misunderstood the importance of not getting it right when we talk to an economist, an author and a businessman who knows why mistakes matter so much? Plus, the science and health and economic benefits and pitfalls of using wearable technologies for our supposed well-being. You can email the show takingstock@newstalk.com or you can message me on socials at Susan Hayes Cullerton. Now, I want to start off by explaining to you some terminology that came up in a piece this week in the Irish Times about how a household could be earning two good salaries and still feel broke. Now, it's a really well-written piece by Joanne Hunt and I recommend that you check it out. She mentioned, though, that the median disposable income for a household in Ireland is €5,000 and €140 per month. So I want to break down those two words, median and disposable. First off, median is the middle number as distinct to the average. And the average can be really affected by extremes, so the median one gives you more clarity. And then, what is disposable income? Well, that is the income after tax, social insurance or PRSI, pension contributions and inter-household transfers. So that would include anything like an inheritance or maybe child support between families and so on like that. And the reason that I'm bringing this up to you is we can make the mistake of looking at average wages and then making assumptions about what that means for lifestyle. But the way in which Joanne looks at it is actually a better way because it gives you a clearer picture. Now, wearable technology has evolved rapidly from simple step counters and fitness trackers into sophisticated health monitoring tools capable of tracking everything from sleep to heart rate variability to blood oxygen levels. But now companies including Oura Health, Fitbit and Whoop are increasingly positioning wearables not simply as wellness products, but as tools that could potentially forecast risks. And that could range from hypertension and heart disease to hormonal changes and even cognitive decline. To discuss this, we're joined now by Stephen O'Rourke, clinical specialist, musculoskeletal, chartered physiotherapist at the Mater University Hospital. First off, Stephen, are we entering an era of predictive healthcare, do you think, powered by AI?
I think we are harnessing, I suppose, the tools that AI is kind of being developed on, particularly within wearables and from, I suppose, we've been kind of looking at them in clinical populations and now you're seeing much more data being presented to us just on a day-to-day basis in terms of our own access to them. But I think probably the technology is advancing a lot faster than maybe public education or conversation, even around kind of ethics or privacy of data or where this data is stored and how we interpret of normal data versus kind of clinical or diagnostic data.
When you say it's advancing faster than we're aware of, I'm trying to think of an example of that. Would it be, let's say I run an update on my smartwatch and now it's collecting something that I'm unaware of? Is that what you mean?
More so in terms of it's giving you all these numbers, you know, on your phone or via a ring or via a watch. And then, you know, how much information and education do we have at our disposal in terms of how to interpret that? Because a lot of those numbers that you're being presented with might be quite normal. And even when they start to fluctuate, some of that fluctuations may be normal. So they're not necessarily diagnostic tools and we shouldn't look at them as diagnostic tools. They're really just guides more around behavior and noticing patterns. And that's when we're kind of saying, well, look, if something significantly changes outside of our normative data or checking in with how we're actually feeling, not just what our kind of watch is telling us, you know, to seek medical treatment or medical advice via a registered healthcare professional.
That's a good point, all right, because sometimes we do get alerts saying, oh, your sleep score was lower or the average such and such a thing is out of kilter. And that isn't necessarily a cause for concern, but it is a point. It's a point to note that we may not be able to interpret that as we should.
Yeah. And I think also knowing that, you know, there's errors within that data, how the data is tracked, interpreted, and, you know, the formulas that are used in the background to make these estimates around, you know, the sleep quality or your recovery, you know, the heart rate variability, that kind of stress and recovery score that you'll often see, you know, some of that is not perfect. Even the step counters or our calorie counters have room for error within that. And there's studies that show that there are errors, you know, that they're not perfect, that they're estimates.
And one thing, though, that is really good about a smartwatch or a smart ring or any of these devices is the fact that if they're worn consistently, you do then get long, continuous, like long duration baselines, instead of maybe in a clinical medicine, you're dealing with snapshots. But is that the way medicine looks at data from this, from these types of wearables? Or does clinical medicine really take any notice of the data that we're collecting on our smart devices?
They really do. And from the basic level of just having a conversation with your GP, you know, it's often something that I'll ask patients to do in clinic around download a health app onto their phone and let's start to track activity from a behavior point of view or an engagement with exercise. But we're seeing a huge shift around, I suppose, digital care, and it's, you know, part of one of the pillars of the HSE and the Department of Health kind of digital for care plan and framework for 2030. And we're already seeing the rollout of these virtual wards. So you're seeing patients being discharged from home early from hospital. Well, not necessarily early, but they're being discharged home with supports virtually. So they're really monitoring. That bedside monitoring that would happen in your hospital is now happening in some patients' homes. So they might be tracking their oxygen levels or heart rate, blood pressure, kind of temperature, various breathing tests. And then they're inputting that in clinical teams within a hospital, then they're interpreting that and using it as a way of keeping patients at home outside of our hospital, freeing up hospital beds to manage patients. And then they're monitoring it to a point where, you know, if something was to change in that patient's status, we can escalate that patient's care and get them readmitted or re-reviewed. So hospitals, I suppose, our interface and the way we are managing health is definitely starting to move into this kind of virtual world.
But that sounds clinically led. In other words, the hospital is directing that, as opposed to me coming in, presenting with my smartwatch and saying, well, this is what the data says, and therefore using that as the basis. What you're describing
100%.
Yeah, with the virtual ward is that's coming from a medical professional in the first place.
And I think that's the risk with these wearables, is that we start to then overinterpret data without that little education piece around what that actually means for, you know, me or you who are not under a virtual ward or being clinician led. And I start to worry and get anxious and stressed about what might actually be quite normal data or normative changes within the data. And we're seeing that within kind of over analysis of sleep scores, where people start to become a little bit more cognizant and almost obsessive around their sleep scores. And rather than asking themselves, look, have I had really restful sleep today, and do I feel rested and ready to take on my day or to exercise, they're looking to their watch and saying, oh God, I had a terrible night's sleep. The watch has told me I've had a terrible night's sleep, and they're going off that rather than just listening to their own bodies.
Is that orthosomnia?
Yes. So it's not necessarily a clinically diagnostic term, but it is something that is quoted within sleep literature, where you're getting this almost over emphasis or anxiety related to overanalysis of sleep.
So you're losing sleep, worrying about the sleep you're not getting. Is that basically it?
People who sleep better don't think about sleep. In the simplest terms, people who start to worry about sleep in terms of being quite controlling about bedtimes, how many hours you're in bed, what my wearable is telling me, you know, that in itself has been shown to start to generate some anxiety around it, and then that can result in actually poorer quality sleep.
I'm wondering as well about who gets this data, because I've seen United Healthcare Medicare Advantage members who use a Fitbit or another activity tracker who can report at least 7,500 steps for 10 days in a month, they can earn a monthly premium discount of $10 on their insurance program. Which means, I'm guessing, that people who are willing to hand over their fitness device data over to a health insurer can now get a discount on their premium. this seems to be happening more and more around the world. Do you see it coming here or even becoming more mainstream, Stephen?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's something that you'll see already. We're seeing pop up in kind of our own private health insurance here in terms of funding or refunding part costs for, say, gym memberships or wearables or kind of apps on your phone for kind of mental health or stress related stuff. You know, they're already started to be covered under our own Irish private insurers. So this, you know, that would be the next step that we start to move towards. Well, look, I've kind of given you a discounted Fitbit. Now I want to make sure you're using it. And I know that if you're moving more, you know, the likelihood is you've got less chance or the chances of kind of developing chronic diseases reduces if you're just engaging with regular activity every day.
I found the latest data that I could find was the Smart Technology 2024 report. It came out of the CSO. And at that stage, more than half, it was 54% of people wear smart devices such as a smartwatch, fitness band, activity tracker. And 1 in 9 or 11% was using smart solutions for monitoring, for example, their blood pressure, sugar levels, body weight, etc. That was, as I say, the data from 2024. Do you think that usage of these devices has increased since then? And are they continuing to do so?
That's a good question. One that I'm not quite sure of the answer. I think it is very person specific. Digital literacy comes into it in terms of how able you are to, I suppose, engage with that. You know, cost, you know, can you afford, you know, one of these? So it comes into kind of health equity then, you know, of like, you know, health outcomes. We know if you're kind of lower socioeconomic status or area and you don't have access, you know, you've got poor health outcomes. So I don't know if more people will use them, but I suppose our engagement with kind of apps and technology is increasing year on year. So I can only see it grow, really.
And Stephen, to this point, we've talked about data that has already been collected. What we haven't talked about is prediction. And I'm keen to know where you think that is going. Wearables do monitor health indicators, but they can't formally diagnose conditions at the moment. Do you see that changing?
I think unless the actual technology we have at home improves, which, you know, potentially, but, you know, it's not clinical diagnostic, the level of which, I suppose, the diagnostic value of the clinical equipment in hospitals, our wearables are not at the same level. So they're really just an indicator. They cannot be diagnostic tools at the moment. And, you know, will the technology develop to the point where a small device on your arm can monitor you the same as kind of hospital grade diagnostic tools? I'm not sure. I certainly don't work in that field of where that's at the minute. So whether I've any indication of whether we're heading in that direction or not, I'm unsure.
But if I can go back to the virtual wards for the moment, is that focusing primarily on bringing people out of hospital? So it's post care.
Yeah, so somebody would be admitted to hospital and then they're identified as being somebody that would be suitable for, I suppose, a discharge to a virtual ward. So they'd be discharged home with that virtual monitoring or virtual support. So we know people who we have, I suppose, beds in hospitals are, you know, a topical thing for many a year. So the virtual wards have been showing they are freeing up hospital beds. And also if we can keep people outside of hospitals and be cared for in their own homes, then from an infection control point of view or getting further hospital-led infections or sickness, then they're only but a positive thing.
Is this also intersecting then with the world of occupational therapy? As in, because an occupational therapist would be evaluating the home to see if it's safe enough for a person to go home, let's say after an injury or if they're in rehabilitation. Is that where looking at the physical world and then the virtual ward technology would intersect together to provide more holistic care?
I suppose it will be a combination of all members of that multidisciplinary team. So, you know, that would be from the occupational therapist look and the physiotherapist, I suppose, looking at the physical environment in which they're going home to, the family supports they have with your social worker, and then your, you know, your community liaison nurse, then your the virtual ward, I suppose, that team that manages that, does that person fall into the criteria of that? And then medical team who will be discharged into that. So there's be a huge number of people from the multidisciplinary team that would feed into the choice of whether that person is suitable for a virtual ward or not.
Do you know, Stephen, when I started talking to you in this conversation, where I was keen to get to was understanding the prediction in terms of prevention. But what you've really done is given us a really interesting insight into how the aftercare and the after somebody is discharged, what the role of wearables, or we'll say the clinically led virtual ward, can provide, and therefore how that ties in with traditional medicine as we might know it. It's been really interesting to talk to you today. Thank you very much for joining me. Stephen O'Rourke, Clinical Specialist, Musculoskeletal Chartered Physiotherapist at the Mater University Hospital.
Thank you very much.
This is Susan A's Cullerton here on Taking Stock and News Talk. After the break, we look at the economics of failure. Welcome back to Taking Stock. This is Susan A's Cullerton. Now for my trivia this week. I was in a city in the past couple of days, and I'm going to give you three clues to see if you can determine which one. The world's first motion picture was shot here in 1895. This city invented the modern automated public bike rental service as recently as 2005. And here is a greater clue. Every December the 8th, the city hosts the Fête de Lumière. Lumière, if I was to roll my R's. Or the Festival of Lights. Now, don't make the assumption of thinking that it's the first answer you can think of, but I will give you the real answer at the end of the show. Now, we often hear statistics about entrepreneurship and setting up your own business, which highlight it's virtually impossible to succeed. But I really want to challenge that assumption, because I think the narrative and the reality don't match up. And what's more, we don't talk about the economics of failure and the impact of what the skills and experience built up in a business that doesn't live on forever actually mean in the economy and to the people in it. So to do a deeper dive on this, we're going to get three different perspectives. Joining me now is economics lecturer at TU Dublin, Emma Howard, and author of Why Startups Fail, Bernie Bulkin. Plus, we're also joined by somebody in the trenches in the form of entrepreneur Kevin O'Loughlin, who is the CEO of Nostra, and he has had to ride out the tough times to achieve business success. So Emma, I'm going to start with you. According to the US Bureau of Labour Statistics, 21.5% of startups fail within their first year, 48.4% fail within 5 years, 65.1% fail within 10 years. What's the macroeconomic effect of this?
Yeah, so those figures in the US, they're pretty in line with what we see in Europe as well. So, you know, many small businesses fail, and, you know, by 5 years, about half of them, one in two businesses, tend to fail. So I suppose there's a few things that we could think about in terms of what the impact of those failures are on the economy. And one, I guess, is in terms of competition. So, you know, when we think about markets and markets being more efficient, efficient markets are ones where producers are forced to cut their costs and to come up with more innovative, more efficient ways of producing their goods. And that's good for consumers, and that's good for the economy overall. So the fact that businesses are failing is showing that, you know, those more efficient or more cost-effective businesses are the ones surviving, and those failures are as a result of, you know, those businesses that really aren't able to compete or aren't able to produce at as low a cost. So that part is good for the economy. I suppose there's other aspects to think about in terms of when you think about setting up a business or any kind of an entrepreneurial endeavor. There is a trade-off between risk and reward. So, you know, when we think about, as economists, and we think about rational decision-making, we tend to think about making changes at the margin. So, you know, you're thinking about a particular action, and you compare the marginal benefits to the marginal costs, and, you know, you make marginal improvements or marginal changes to your existing plan of action. And while that is a low-risk way of doing things, those kind of marginal changes don't really lead to big innovations. So what we probably see with some businesses is ones where they are taking those bigger risks. So, you know, if you are going to try and set up a business or produce something that isn't on the market, that isn't tested, there's a much bigger risk to it. And, you know, along with that risk, of course, is the possibility of failure and that it's not going to work out. But where you're taking those risks, you have the potential to reap much bigger rewards. So, you know, you may end up creating something really innovative and making huge profits down the line. And, you know, in terms of innovation in the economy, we need to have some of those big risk takers to actually progress and advance. And of course, those failures that happen along the way, in a lot of industries, what we have are spillovers. So, you know, we have learnings that even though your business might fail, perhaps a lot of that knowledge, a lot of those innovations that you might have created spill over and are adapted by other firms who can then go on and improve their product for consumers as well.
In fairness to you, Emma, one of the reasons that I really like to talk to you is because you give a balanced and a rounded approach as opposed to looking at this solely from one negative perspective. There is roundedness to that, which is the impact of the learnings and the spillover. But Kevin, I want to put Emma's first point to you, which is, as economists, one might look at the market or look at the world and say, how do you make changes at the margin? It doesn't work like that, though, in business, does it? You can't just say, well, I'll tweak X and Y. Often you need to take big strategic bets. What's been your experience?
Well, I think when you look at it from a business perspective, I mean, it's pretty rare you sit down in a meeting. Certainly when everything is going well, you might. But at a startup business or when you're trying to grow something, you know, you're almost always trying to run from the fire as opposed to actually aiming at something. You know, the bottom line is people come across opportunities, ways of doing things better. But certainly most businesses at the starting point is about survival. You know, like a simple example, you know, we were the first Irish company to do cloud technology back in 2007, right? So that's 19 years ago now. And that was a pure survival mechanism. You know, the spend in IT was starting to collapse. Companies, you know, didn't have the money that they had during the Celtic Tiger era and boom time. And we had to find a way to find a new, more cost-effective solution that actually delivered value. And ultimately, we came across the cloud in a conference in Washington, D.C. in 2007. And we said, hang on, this could solve a problem. You know, if we weren't in a crisis mode, we wouldn't have been looking. And I think one of the great things about diversity and business challenges or adversity and business challenges is, you know, some of the greatest innovations in the world came out of the toughest times. And that's I think that's when innovation is absolutely at its best.
While I agree with you that necessity is the mother of all innovation, Kevin, I also wouldn't recommend it to anybody to get into a crisis so that they may sharpen the saw. How do you think businesses can proactively develop resilience and still keep sharp?
I think businesses have to keep an eye on, you know, for me, certainly it's very simple. Our methodology is listen to our customers, spend a lot of time with them, understand their business challenges. And then, you know, certainly again, in our case, it's leave Ireland. We spend a lot of time out of Ireland. We spend a lot of time looking at how technology is innovating. You know, like we're looking at things at the moment that won't exist in the public domain for probably 12 or 18 months from now. And we're looking to see how can it be. So, I mean, our name is Nostra, which comes from Nostradamus, which comes from see the future. So I think, you know, there are companies that want to be innovative, like us. We want to be the first to market with anything new that's out there. And we're constantly looking at what are the challenges our clients have and how do we deal with them. And the current challenge most organizations have is AI is out there. How the hell do we bring it in and deliver it to our business and make it something that's going to move the needle? Everyone's talking about it and I feel left out. You know, so we're out now looking at what are the actual practical steps the company can take in Ireland today to move the needle internally to make AI something that's very real.
And I'm going to pick up on the point about the risk that comes with being first in a little while in our conversation, Kevin. But first of all, Bernie, in your preface in the book, and just to repeat the name, the book is Why why startups fail. You put forward a definition of failure, which I don't always see, and that is when investors do not get more money back than they could have received by simply investing in a fund tracking an index like the S&P 500, that's defined as failure. And while I get the concept of that, which is that if I could put my money into the stock market and let others basically work at it, and then I get the return of that in comparison to what I would do if I was to set up my own, the challenge I'd have for you is that money is just one input that goes into a business. There's time, effort, energy, reputation, and a lot more. So isn't that a narrow definition?
I take that definition for the investors who are putting money in, which as distinct from what does failure mean for the entrepreneurs who are setting up the business and working in it. So two separate. And I say that for people who are working in the business, the entrepreneurs who are setting it up, they are devoting some years of their life working long hours, for sure, and a lot of emotional commitment to this business. Now, for them, they have to ask, what have I learned during this period? And would I have, and what have I earned and what have I learned during the period working this business? And how does that compare to what I would have earned and learned working, say, for a big company in a secure job, but a challenging job? So there's a measure of success or failure, both for the investors and for the people working in the business. And I think they are different.
And Bernie, you have been in business yourself, as well as being an author, and you have invested in businesses yourself. Can I ask you, what have you earned and learned from doing either?
Oh, I've learned lots. And occasionally, I've earned money. I mean, I worked with a group in California that was the first investors in Tesla. So we made some money from that, but we also invested in a whole bunch of things that didn't make money. I think my focus is mostly on technology-related businesses. And by the way, the statistics you cited at the beginning from the U.S., that includes all businesses. That would include restaurants and dry cleaners and so on, as well as tech businesses. The failure rates for the tech businesses are even higher.
And so, Bernie, just to the reason that I quoted all businesses is that I think we need to focus in on all businesses as distinct to either one sector or indeed just businesses that we invest money into, let's say in a private equity scenario. Thank you for pointing that out, but I just wanted to highlight the fact that I think a rounded approach to this is important in the conversation.
Absolutely. But so I was going to say my learnings are that, first of all, that there's not one cause of failure, that there are multiple things that can go wrong, and that I believe, and the theme of what I've written is that some of these causes, maybe even most of the causes of failure, are avoidable. And these don't necessarily lead to the next Google or Amazon or Tesla, the big gigantic, or Nvidia, the gigantic winners, but they do lead to sustainable businesses that can return 3, 4, 5 times what was invested in them.
This is Susan A's Cullerton here on Taking Stock and News Talk, and I'm talking to Emma Howard, author Bernie Bulkin, and the CEO of Nostra, Kevin O'Loughlin, about the importance and economics of failure. We're going to take a quick ad break and we'll be back to you shortly. Now, you're welcome back to Taking Stock here on News Talk. I'm Susan A's Cullerton and we're talking about the role that failure plays in business and the broader economy. I'm joined by economist Emma Howard, Bernie Bulkin, the author of Why Startups Fail, and Kevin O'Loughlin, who is the CEO of Nostra. Okay, Emma, I want to pick up with you on the point you made earlier about how the US statistics are quite similar to that in Europe. But if we look at the European failure rates around the continent, France sits near 85%. Germany and the Netherlands hover around 80%. The UK is 60 to 70%. Switzerland leads at a relatively low 65%. What is it about the market conditions that can lead to such a difference in a specific country?
Yeah, there are different market conditions that can lead to different failure rates and, I suppose, different optimal stopping problems. If you think about, you know, when you are in the middle of running a business and when things, you know, as Kevin outlined earlier, you know, where you can reach a crisis point and what do you do? You know, do you look for a new innovation or, you know, do you decide to call it quits? So there's lots of different factors in the business environment that will lead to you potentially taking another bigger risk or calling it a day and quitting. And I think that there are differences, particularly between the EU and the US, on bankruptcy laws, for example. So, you know, the different treatment of debtors versus creditors. And there's definitely more of a risk appetite in the US compared to Europe. But there's also less of a safety net. And again, there's kind of a trade-off between this encouraging businesses to take risks and rewarding risk-taking. There's a trade-off between that and kind of overall equality or inequality in the society. So, you know, you look at the US and as you say, the failure rates are probably lower in the US, and you know we've got higher levels of productivity. But on the other side of it, we've got much higher rates of income inequality in the US. So if you look at the Gini coefficient that measures income inequality, so where zero would mean kind of perfect equality, everybody earns the same amount, and 100 means one person has all the income. The US is at nearly 42, compared to the EU average is at just about 29. So you've got really high income inequality in the US, and you know partly that's driven by the sort of lack of penalties for that risk taking, or not lack of, but lower penalties to risk taking compared to the EU, which does have positive results for individuals, but does also perpetuate that inequality. So I think that's one aspect to it. And the other aspect is, you know, again, Bernie was outlining the different definition of success and failure for investors and for entrepreneurs. And of course, for the entrepreneurs themselves, those opportunity costs can be really high when you're investing in a business. And like, for example, you could have put in a lot of your own money as well as your own time into a particular business. And irrational decision-making can creep in those scenarios where a lot of people are subject to what we call the sunk cost fallacy. So where rather than at a particular point in time thinking about, okay, is this next step in my business? Does it make sense? Do the costs outweigh the benefits? And ignoring that kind of that sunk cost of the time or the money that you've already spent, because that's not recoverable, you can't get it back. A lot of people tend to focus on those sunk costs and make a decision to continue because they've put so much into the business. And so what that can do if you know, if there's sort of factors in the environment that make particular countries or particular environments where people focus more on those sunk costs and where there's more irrational decision making, that can lead to higher rates of failure. And also bigger costs associated with that failure.
Right, Kevin. If we take that on board and think about the success and failure definitions there and the opportunity costs, I do want to think back to what I had said I wanted to ask you about, which is, as you say, the name of your business is Nostra, which is looking into the future. There's a big risk with being a first mover, which is that, number one, it can be costly financially and otherwise to go into an area that other people haven't explored because you have to learn it all and that can be expensive. But the second thing is, there may not be a market. There might be a gap in the market, but not a market in the gap. So how do you look at those success and failure potentials and make sure that you don't suffer from, as Emma says, their irrational decision-making as you do?
Well, I look at it very differently now than I did 19 years ago when I naively went in and became the first cloud provider in Ireland, because it seemed incredibly obvious to me that it was the way to go. But actually, the adoption of it didn't come for 5 years later. And we had a very hard slog for those 5 years trying to explain to people the benefits. So the challenge with being a first mover adopter is huge. And you know, what I would say is the difference, what a lot of people don't understand, is you have to educate the entire market apart from selling them a solution. So one, you have to tell them the solution exists, then tell them why it's better than the old solution, and then explain it to them. And the market understands it.
Do you have to go back further, Kevin, and highlight that they have a problem in the first place that is seeking said solution?
Yeah, well, not necessarily. I mean, because obviously innovation can just change. I mean, you might not have a problem. So, I mean, that if I look at the email things that happened in 2007, 2008, people were buying in email servers. They worked really, really well. The problem was that they only had 1% utilization. Most people were using a fraction of the power and performance an investment that they made in email. So by having it on the cloud, it meant an organization like Microsoft could get 100% utilization of a system and therefore gain efficiencies and pass those efficiencies on to people. You know, what I would certainly say is, you know, we look at it very differently today. So we would invest very heavily. We'd make sure that we can handle the length of time. And we definitely overestimate what you can achieve with new products in a year, and underestimate what you can do in 4 or 5 years. I mean, there's a phrase which is the second mouse gets the cheese, which is a common phrase used. You know, and we nearly collapsed in 2010 and in 2011 because ultimately the market hadn't moved. We had invested in the technology. People weren't buying it, even though it was the right thing for them to do, because nobody wanted to be the first one to move on to something different. And they were incredibly difficult times. So today we're much more structured. And I would say that the advantage of being an early mover, if you can ride out the wave and the cost of the delay in getting it to market, you know, in 2013, when everyone wanted to move to the cloud, we were the only company with 6 years, 7 years experience of it. And therefore, we really won from that point and took off as a business. And that was a real catalyst for us being there. But, you know, we very nearly didn't make it to that point, and plenty of other IT companies were there waiting to get the cheese.
And now that you're expanding more so into the UK and further afield, has the risk changed then? Because while the prize might be bigger, you have to deepen the foundation along the way to do it.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, as companies mature, your risk appetite absolutely changes. I mean, you're at a startup business, you know, typically you might be the only shareholder, you might have some early investors, and obviously you have to take risks. You've nothing to lose because you've no customers, you have no history, you might even have no profitability. So you have to get your first win. You know, we would be much more measured now in doing it. We would be, you know, we would never bite off more than we can chew. You know, we would be, you know, when we acquire a business, which is one of the things that we do quite often, you know, we'll only buy a business that's maybe a maximum of 25 or 30% of our turnover. So even on its worst day, we can sustain a hit if it ever came to it. So we're much more measured as we get bigger. We have shareholders to think about. We've got staff to think about. And just, you know, one of the points you made earlier about what's the definition of success for business. You know, I think a lot of founders look at a business as a legacy, and probably more than we think. And, you know, I suppose what I would say, certainly from my perspective, is when somebody's reading my eulogy, hopefully in a long way into the future, you know, rather than, you know, Kevin made 11% in the S&P 500 for the last 35 years, and he's a very wealthy man, you would almost prefer to say he built a business, created hundreds of jobs, you know, helped thousands of organizations, you know, and even if it fails in 20 years' time, that you've done it for that period of time. And entrepreneurs, you know, while there's an element of financial success is important to them, most entrepreneurs and most really successful businesses, the definition of success is achieving something that is one, beyond their initial expectations, but two, it's solving a significant problem along the way. And I've met entrepreneurs who've lost their companies, again, by being early mover adopters, but they've changed the market and they're incredibly proud of that. And their definition of it is it was a success, even though it failed.
We learned a lot about you in that answer, actually, Kevin, and I'll remember that when the time comes, all going well. It'll be a very long time away. Bernie, it annoys me immensely when I hear people talk about startup failure without realizing that, you know, being a founder is also a job. Like, I've had a business for 15 years, continue to do so, for many of the reasons that Kevin mentioned there, actually. And if I decided that I just didn't want to do the job anymore and, let's say, work for a big company, that would be called business failure. But if I was an accountant and retrained to become an engineer, that would be called job mobility. Like, why are labels put on entrepreneurs like this that can really, you know, nuance the figures then that Emma discussed earlier on?
Well, I think that being an entrepreneur is such a, for most people, and this came out in what Kevin was just talking about, is such a complete personal, emotional, psychological commitment to a business that it is different from being an accountant and changing to being an engineer or whatever. I think anyone, and I've been in started businesses which I worked at really hard, and eventually we failed, but it was an enormous personal commitment, and that I think is what distinguishes it from anything else that people do with their lives, with their professional lives.
And on that note, you also mentioned as well, Bernie, earlier on, you said that most of the reasons that business fail are avoidable. From your own experience, what do you think one should really take away from that? What is low-hanging fruit to avoid problems?
Well, I also said that there's not a single cause of failure. So for each business, let's just take a few things that have already come up in the conversation. Kevin talked quite rightly about the need to educate his customers to the next innovation, the next product, and so on. But of course, first thing is you have to have some customers, and you have to educate the market, as has already come up, to the need for what you're going to do. Well, that is very different if the customers are retail customers from what it is if they are business customers. And if they are big businesses, you really have to understand the structure of the market. How do you access a Mercedes, Daimler-Benz, or a Shell, or a big company? You don't necessarily access it by going as a startup and saying, here's my great innovation, because they don't buy from small companies. They buy from other suppliers, tier one suppliers, tier two suppliers. And you have to really understand the structure of the market. If it's retail customers, maybe you can get some traction with software innovations, but maybe you need someone else to help you educate them to the need for your product. So the whole business of talking to customers, getting your first customers, is something that you really need to work at, rather than just saying, here's a big market, all we have to get is 1% of it and we'll be fine.
What I'm hearing you say there, Bernie, is that it's important not to lock yourself into an ivory tower and keep shining your product to make it more and more suitable and attractive to nobody without getting out there and facing what could be a bruising conversation when your first couple of people you talk to might say, I don't like it, or I don't want it, or I'm not willing to pay for it. It's been really interesting to talk to you all, and I'm very glad that we took a geographically diverse as well as an emotional and psychological as well as a statistical journey there with you all. Really appreciate your time today. Thank you very much indeed. Economics lecturer at TU Dublin, Emma Howard, author of Why Startups Fail, Bernie Balkin, and also entrepreneur Kevin O'Loughlin, who is the CEO of Nostra. Thanks so much for joining us here on Taking Stock.
Thank you.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you.
Now, for the answer to my trivia this week. So I was in a city and I gave you three clues earlier in the show to see if you could determine which one. The world's first motion picture was shot here in 1895. This city invented the modern automated public bike rental service in 2005. And every December the 8th, the city hosts the Fête de Lumière, or the Festival of Lights. Now, it would be very tempting to say it's Paris, because, of course, Paris is known as the City of Lights. But it's not actually. It is Lyon in France. I was there during the week. An absolutely stunning city. A place I'd love to explore more. It was my first time there. And I learned an awful lot about it while I was. And that's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan Hayes-Cullerton. I hope you enjoyed the show and possibly even learned something about economics and how it affects our world. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the Go Loud app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. And please do pop the link for it into your WhatsApp groups for anyone who might be interested in listening. It's also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of Taking Stock is John Faraday, and on research this week was Simon Keane. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thanks a million for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.
Taking Stock with Susan Hayes-Cullerton on News Talk.
With Nifty Business, the fleet management specialists. Helping businesses unlock growth with a leased vehicle fleet.